Voice of the International African Revolution.
Days of John Brown,
would you walk?
when they killed Martin?
Oh, yeah.
Where were you when they killed George Jackson?
Oh, yeah.
Do you hear them
calling?
Are you living today?
Oh.
Uhuru, you are listening to Diasporic Music on Uhuru Radio. My name is Norman Otis Richmond, a.k.a. Jalali, speaking to you from the not-so-great white north here in Toronto, Canada. And we came out of the box tonight with Sweet Honey in the Rock. Sweet Honey in the Rock gave us Biko, and If You Had Lived, Sweet Honey in the Rock, are coming to Toronto on Saturday, February the 20th, and they are going to be at Kerner Hall. They're going to be doing two shows, one for families during the day, and then the 8 p.m. show, of course, will be for everyone, and it should be a great show. I would like to begin this show like I begin every show by thanking two people. Chairman O'Malley Ishitella, the chair of the African People's Socialist Party and the African Socialist International, for giving me the space to do Diasporic Music on Uhuru Radio. And I would also like to thank Archie Shepp for giving me the concept of Diasporic Music, music made in the West, but not of the West. And, you know, Diasporic Music is supposed to be the music that Africans make who are outside of Africa, those of us that are in Nova Scotia, those of us that are in Brazil, those of us that are in England, we're in the islands, but we cheat because we do play music from people who don't live, who live in other spots as well. Wherever you may be, if you are of African origin, we will play your music. And Diasporic Music is one of the shows that we have here on Uhuru Radio. We want you to stay tuned for many shows on Diasporic Music. Stay tuned 24/7. And this is African Liberation Month. And we're going to have two guests on today. We're going to have Abdul Al-Khaliman, and he's going to talk about, you know, how we have gone from Negro History Week to Black Liberation Month or African Liberation Month. We started out with, as Negroes, today we are Africans. We started out with a week and we have a month, and we started out talking about history, and now some of us maintain that we should talk about a liberation. And I'm not putting down people like George Washington Carver, because we need everybody. But sometimes we talk about George Washington Carver and the peanut, but we do not talk about Dessalines. We do not talk about Ya Asantewaa. We do not talk about Queen Nzinga. We do not talk about the contribution that the League of Revolutionary Black Workers and the Black Panther Party and the African People's Socialist Party and the Republic of New Africa made. And African Liberation Month is about giving space to African people that have a radical black ideology. Right now, we want to continue. We're going to present the music of, we're going to take you to Africa now. We're going to present Youssou N'Dour, and we're also going to present Bob Marley and the Wailers. And we're also going to listen to Hubert Winston McIntosh, a.k.a. Peter Tosh, a.k.a. Walde Simayat. So let's begin with let Yusu Endur from Senegal take us to Africa.
Man Yusu Endur mangi wo bepu domu Africa. Ñu bokku xalat bokku gis gis bokk yeene sans frontière bon les sunu am am te liguee waratuñu nangu kenn ñew diñu fewale bul jiite réew fokk ne la fa nekk yow yaa ko moom njit bu dëgër dana war a fekk nga bëgg sa réew te sàkku ndimbal ndimbal na ca fekk loxol boro wuy Africa bu jant bi fenkee waaw na la fekk joo ak sa jumtukaay bëccëg bi gaaw na ñett du bëree te ñaara mën kenn waaw yoon wi sore naa te metti naa na ñu ko waaja ba dul na bexaat lañu defoon naa sa xol dootul neex sa dootoo xalaat loo dul fayantoo su ma sañoon Africa benn nit moo koy jiite ñu boole sunuy xalaat ak sunuy doole jokkoo nañu bi frontière yi taxal yoon yi ba ñëpp a gisee cincooti kiiñ wóog tuugeeda kiipan wóokiin Cheikh Anta Diop Kwame Nkrumah Stephen Biko Oliou Bimba Africa
let it be done. I tell you who
Nanga Def, you are listening to Diasporic Music on Uhuru Radio. My name is Jalali, a.k.a. Norman Otis Richmond, and Nanga Def is Wolof. And Wolof is speaking in, or spoken, pardon me, my Ebonics are coming out, spoken in Senegal, the Gambia, and Mauritania, and those Wolof people around the world. Great language, and Jetty Jeff, I believe, is thank you. But once again, Nanga Def, and we are getting ready to listen to Mumia Abu Jamal. And Mumia Abu Jamal is going to be talking about the water situation. And the water situation, water is an issue that's it's going to be hotter than oil very shortly. And it's Michigan, Flint, Michigan is in trouble, and Flint, Michigan is the beginning of what we're going to see. And Mumia talks about water, and then we're going to hear from Dead Prez, and we're going to listen to Earth, Wind, and Fire, and Abdullah Kaliman is going to come on and talk about African Liberation Month or Black Liberation Month. And we're going to be listening, or we're going to be speaking to L. Jones out of Halifax, Nova Scotia, a little bit later. But let's listen to some spoken word right now with Mumia Abu Jamal.
Flint, water wars against the poor. If ever one wonders about the efficacy of a state government imposing officials on local government, Flint, Michigan has answered that question forever. In April 2014, the state-appointed emergency manager, in order to save money, ordered that the city's water source be changed from Lake Huron to the notoriously polluted Flint River. The switch unleashed a citywide disaster of disease, destruction, and death. Flint was a toxic river, rich in lead, a major pollutant that has devastating effects on brain development, speech, and IQ levels, especially in children. As soon as it was pumped out into municipal water systems, the waters leached lead from the old pipes and sped it to some 99,000 homes in the city. Flint is now a poisoned city because of its toxic water. It also illustrates how officials from afar can cause a catastrophe at home. Now, tens of thousands of children who drank the water and were bathed in the water may suffer lifelong problems, skin diseases, cognitive impairment, speech deficits, and more. The state, being penny wise and pound foolish, has created a problem that may last for generations. The state's emergency manager created an emergency. The Michigan example of the politics of austerity will cause problems that will cost billions of dollars to resolve, if ever. The politics of ignoring the problems of the poor erupt like lava, demanding national attention. Michigan, by the way, is named after the Chippewa words Michigamma, meaning great water. Michigan Governor Rick Snyder will be remembered not for great water, but for toxic water. For imprisoned nation, this is Mumia Abu Jamal.
It's all love, all love, all
sweets, only ripe vegetables, fresh fruit and whole wheat. I'm from the old school, my household smell like soul food, bruh. Curry falafel, barbecue tofu, no fish though, no candy bars, no cigarettes, only ganja, fresh squeezed juice from oranges. Exercising daily to stay healthy, and I rarely drink water out the tap cause it's filthy.
Lentil soup is mental fruit and ginger root is good for the youths. Fresh vegetable with them Itai stew. Sweet yam fries with the green callaloo. Careful how you season and prepare your foods, cause you don't wanna lose vitamins and minerals, and that's the jewel. Life brings life, it's valuable. So I eat what come from the ground, it's natural. Let your food be your medicine, no accelerant. Strictly herbs and rays from the sun, cause I got melanin and drink water. 8 glasses a day, cause that's what they say.
They say you are what you eat, so I strive to eat healthy. My goal in life is not to be rich or wealthy, cause true wealth comes from good health and wise ways. We got to start taking better care of ourselves. They say you are what you eat, so I strive to eat healthy. My goal in life is not to be rich or wealthy, cause true wealth comes from good health and wise ways. We got to start taking better care of ourselves. Be healthy, y'all.
We'll be right back.
Habarigani. This is Norman Otis Richmond, a.k.a. Jalali, along with Melinda Francis, a.k.a. Molly, and Lisa Watson is on the buttons, and joining us on the line is Abdul Al-Kalimat, and Abdul Al-Kalimat is the author of a great book, new book called, let me see, Roots and Flowers, The Life and Work of Afro-Cuban Liberian Marta Terry Gonzalez, and this book was penned by Abdul Al-Kalimat and Kate Williams. I have to give everybody credit. And Abdul Al-Kalimat, how are you doing today?
Good, good. Glad to be with you.
I guess the first question I wanted to ask you, I would be remiss if I didn't ask you about the question of water in Flint, Michigan. I got an executive mandate from Maxwell Curtis Stanford Jr., a.k.a. Muhammad Ahmed, and he gave me this executive mandate to do a special on Flint, Michigan, which I think we should do, but I couldn't get a hold of anyone. So I just briefly wanted to get your thoughts on Flint, Michigan. I know you have been there, and you know a little bit about the city.
Well, I think that, first of all, this is a very important moment. Beginning, of course, with the fact that the population of Flint, being working class and majority African American, has been poisoned by the state. And it's important to sort of speak about that at the abstract level. Of course, individuals played a role. The governor played a role, Republican governor. The emergency manager, African American man, played a role. But it was the state. And the state, as we know, is a function and an arm, essentially, of the ruling capitalist class. Now, it's important to say that because in 2016, we are 80 years from the great Flint sit-down strike, one of the highest stages of objective struggle of the working class against capital. And in this instance, it was the auto industry. And so there were great gains made out of the Autolite strike that occurred sometime before that in Toledo, Ohio. Some of those same organizers went to Flint. The Flint sit-down strike then leads to the development of the CIO and the highest stage of trade unionism in the United States. Well, 80 years later...
Was the CIO, was that led by John Lewis?
Yes.
Okay, go ahead. Sorry for cutting you.
80 years later... capital, through the state, has now poisoned that very working class that woke up and fought back and made gains. So we have to take...
Sounds like Haiti.
Exactly. We have to look at the big picture. And we also have to look at the contradiction between reform and revolution. Now, reform is about adjusting the state and adjusting the relations with the working, with the ruling class to make things better. So obviously, the people in Flint are going to make claims on the state to clean up the water and to provide health care for the people who have already been poisoned. And that, of course, will take place over generations because that lead poisoning is going to be passed along from the adults to the children. And they're going to suffer from diseases and biological problems that will then result in... So it's going to be many generations before this is dealt with. But those reforms are obviously very limited. And so we then have to raise the question, if the state is murdering the working class and poor people, is there any other option than having a vision beyond capitalism and a need to form organizations that can actually resist capital to take power? Now, that sounds radical, and it sounds like an impossible dream. But in the United States, we have now an active discussion about socialism on the basis of the candidacy of Bernie Sanders. Now, on the right, people will say socialism is a fanciful dream, it'll never happen. On the left, there's the attack against Bernie Sanders, is that he's not a real socialist. But the reality is, for the American people, for the average person, a debate over any kind of socialism begins to move people beyond thinking that we have no other option but to suffer under capitalism. And so we have a moment here in this country where the possibility of discussing something beyond capitalism is right here on us. And the contradiction of in Flint, now, by the way, Flint is not the only city in the United States suffering from lead poisoning. There are about four or five other cities where the school system has had to shut down, and they have the same kind of problem of lead in the water. Then we have the escaping of gas from storage facilities in California that, again, are poisoning the population. So we have a breakdown where capital has not been reinvesting in the infrastructure of the country, has not been taking care. And matter of fact, that's just giving them the benefit of the doubt, right? That's not saying they intend this to happen. So we're really at a critical moment of looking at this historically and then also looking at it in terms of what kind of politics makes sense for the working class.
You're listening to Diasporic Music on Uhuru Radio with Abdullah Kalimat, and we're going to discuss from Negro History Week to African Liberation Month or Black Liberation Month, and I wanted to turn it over to Melinda.
Hi, yes. So we're heading in, well, we are in Black History Month. So I was wondering if we could kind of roll back and talk a little bit about Carter Woodson.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, first let me say that this is a really an important time because it gives us an opportunity to reflect on many things. One of them, of course, is Carter G. Woodson, who is often regarded as the father of Black history because of his work. He got his undergraduate degree from the University of Chicago and then went on to Harvard to get a degree in history, the second African-American to do so after W.E.B. Du Bois. And Woodson was important because he not only worked in higher education, more importantly, he worked outside of higher education and founded many things that produce what we call public history. This is a very important concept because we now, today, are dealing with what are called public intellectuals versus public history. And I want to make a distinction between those two things. Public intellectuals represent an individual and a top-down approach to historical understanding, whereas public history stressed a collective approach and a bottom-up approach in the sense that the majority of people were unleashed by Carter G. Woodson in his concept of Negro History Week. Now, this is a very important concept, but there was something that came even before Carter G. Woodson. When Black people were slaves, afterwards they created a public holiday called Emancipation Day, which was January 1st. In fact, Black people even developed a special meal that people would eat on January 1st in honor of our emancipation from slavery. Black-eyed peas, hog head cheese, all kinds of things. And then, started in 1863, and that lasted until 1925, because in 1926, Carter G. Woodson created Negro History Week. And this was something that was taken up by churches, by community organizations, in recognition that Black people came from somewhere, and contributed to world history and certainly to U.S. history. And so racism was saying Black people contributed nothing, Black people were intellectually incapable of creating anything, Black people had no culture. And so Carter G. Woodson then unleashed people to reaffirm themselves on this week, which was started in honor of Frederick Douglass. In the 1960s, the explosion of black consciousness and black power and black studies led to the concept moving from week to month and from Negro to black. So now we have Black History Month. And that's the legacy, really, of Carter G. Woodson.
You're listening to Diaspora Music on Uhuru Radio, where it's on the line with Abdul Al-Kalimant. And had you finished that point?
Yes.
Yeah.
The whole question of you are arguing that, the contribution that I know El Hajj Malik El Shabazz Malcolm X was very, very hard on Carter, on George Washington Carver, the Peanut Man. Mm-hmm. And I tend to agree with Malcolm to a certain degree, but I don't really think we can belittle people that made contributions, any kind of contributions. But the whole question of liberation as opposed to just history, I agree with your concept of it's time to move from history to liberation. Could you explain that concept?
Yeah, we in the Black Liberation Movement of the 1960s, which moved from the Civil Rights Movement to regain the real thrust of the Radical Black Tradition, which was a freedom movement. And so the Civil Rights Movement was moving the freedom movement under the U.S. Constitution to fight for reforms in adjusting the system incrementally. And so as the 60s progressed and the limitations of the Civil Rights Movement were confronted, particularly as the movement moved regionally from the South to the North, and we had the real confrontation, not with being included, but what it was like to be included, and therefore black liberation became the theme. Beyond civil rights. And of course, Malcolm was the main ideologist that helped everyone make that transition, along with organizations like the League of Revolutionary Black Workers, the Black Panther Party, et cetera. So Black Liberation Movement became what the radical tradition moved to beyond civil rights. And in that context, in 1971, we advanced the notion that we have to, every February, ask the question, history for what? And our answer to that was the history is for black liberation. Therefore, we propose that we move to not Black History Month, but beyond that, as we've moved from Negro to black and week to month, we move from history to liberation. And so we put forward the idea of Black Liberation Month. Now, what's interesting is to ask yourself the question about memory. What is it that black people remember? And one of the interesting things is every February we struggle to remember the words to lift every voice and sing. You know, maybe you got the first verse, but that second verse you got to struggle with. And then there are the black inventors. And as you say, you know, people like George Washington Carver, exactly what did he do, and so on. But when you talk about freedom and you talk about Frederick Douglass or Nat Turner or Harriet Tubman and Sojourner Truth, these names tend to be more remembered. You know, there's a brother that invented the machine to sew the soles of shoes on, but nobody can remember that. You need a list of those inventors. But you don't need a printed list to get Frederick Douglass, Nat Turner, and Harriet Tubman. And so we began to realize that black people had more memory of people who contributed to the liberation struggle than they had of people who made other kinds of contributions, though in their own right, as you indicated, were important. In other words, every time a black person did something in the society, it rejected the racism that said that they weren't supposed to be able to do that. So when we put forward a Black Liberation Month, we were stressing the notion that it's important to ask the question, history for what? Not history for personal advancement, you know, not history for acceptance in the mainstream, but history for the liberation of our people. And that's kind of what we wanted to focus on.
You are listening to Diasporic Music on Uhuru Radio, and Molly, you have another question?
Yeah, I'm guessing what the effects of you know, basically the corporatization, I mean, here in Toronto, like, you know, Black History Month, a lot of the events are sponsored by, you know, banks. So I just wanted to know, with that sort of like framework, how in that new proposal, or that proposal that, you know, people have been saying for a while, to move towards African liberation, what is that effect? And I guess it's sort of similar to like the, you know, reform revolution kind of paradigm. So I was just wondering, yeah, like the effect of corporatization around that move towards African liberation.
Right. This is a very interesting thing. I mean, it's sort of like a dance we're doing through history. You know, there was a company in the United States that would teach people how to dance. Arthur Murray, it was called.
Right.
And so every time the people would create a dance, eventually Arthur Murray would create a textbook and be able to teach people how to do that dance. But by
and
the
make
time
money.
Arthur Murray taught people how to do that dance, the people were doing some other dance. In other words, Arthur Murray was struggling to keep up with the people and making some money out of it. So here we've got Black History Month, where now, today, and this is all because of the 60s, the society, the banks and the corporations and so forth, the mainstream, has adopted Black History Month and turned it into something that they can support. And that's another reason why we, the people, have to keep moving forward and keep our eyes on the prize and begin to talk about freedom. And in fact, once we begin to talk about liberation, then we have to ask the question, is liberation possible under capitalism? This is a fundamental question. And if it's not possible under capitalism, then we have to start thinking out of the box. And ultimately, once we unleash that level of thinking, just like King did, Malcolm did, and so forth, the society is going to stop smiling and start baring its teeth. But the reality is that when it bares its teeth, it's just revealing, really, on its face, what they're already doing on a daily basis. Because if you look out here among the masses of people, no matter that the TV is saying the economy is back on track, et cetera, the masses of people are suffering worse than they have in a very long time. And so we know, you know, it's just like Malcolm would say, you know, don't be afraid of fighting back and maybe risking your life. You're risking your life if you don't fight back. So there's no escape of that. You might as well give freedom a try.
Well, there are two women in Toronto, Canada, and they were on the left. One was an African born in Nova Scotia. She went to Montreal, then she came to Toronto. And another one was a Jewish woman. I'm speaking of Jean Daniels and Jackie Schaffenberg, and in the 40s and 50s, in the 50s, they basically started celebrating Negro History Week, and they have been written out of history. I don't know, there's not too many people in this city who even have heard of those two people, and I think the reason they have never heard of them is because they were on the left. Jean Daniels used to she organized a demonstration against George Wallace when he came to Toronto. She led the anti-apartheid movement. She was one of the first people to lead the anti-apartheid movement. She was a very petite woman, and she had a contralto voice. I mean, she was had a deep voice and was very, very public. She's an intellectual that She had no degree, but I mean, she knew history backwards, forwards, sideways, and she was a hell of an organizer. Basically, I think that's what we're talking about. People like that have been written off, wouldn't you say, in every city?
Oh, absolutely. One of the interesting things about Black Studies, which is very much a part of this whole Black History Month, because it's the institutionalized study of Black history, is that Black Studies has been delinked from the community. And I would argue that not only is there a Black academic history in the Black colleges and universities that's ignored, but the community and the movement have also been the basis, the historical background of Black Studies. And so the bookstores, the self-publishing, the community centers, the art movements, the musical movements, the real unbroken tradition of freedom of thinking and creative production is in our music. All of those things were the way in which Black people maintained a self-affirmation and a retention of history and a connection to the Africa and African diaspora. This is something that once you delink from it, then you can create any kind of references so that you can make people refer to mainstream white intellectual tradition to try to find meaning for your life, when in fact, if you had a grasp of Black intellectual history, then you would have that affirmation of your life from the origins of your very life itself. And so these community intellectuals are really a vital resource for our self-understanding and for understanding in the future. Because today, much of Black Studies has delinked from the community. And therefore, the students end up feeling like it is the campus and not the community. And so they begin to feel like they're all of that because they've been to the campus. When in fact, people who leave the campus and go back to the community have to be re-educated by the elders and the community leaders before they can be an asset for the community. This, after all, is what Carter G. Woodson talked about in The Miseducation of the Negro.
Well, we have maybe about 2 or 3 minutes left, and I would like for Melinda to ask you the last question, because we have to get out of here, get in the whirlwind, as they say.
I guess what, and moving forward, for next year, what do you think, you know, sort of reconnecting, Black history to like the community, how does that even look like, and how can we do that?
Well, for example, I think that one of the interesting aspects of how Black people have dealt with Negro History Week and Black History Month is to take every day of February and say, okay, what historically happened on that day? Like, for example, this very day, the 7th of February is when Carter Woodson started Negro History Week. And so that's one approach, is to and the other is to begin to ritualize and commemorate the history of the community. So, for example, in my own case, Black American culture in Chicago in the 1960s. And one of the things we did was the visual arts workshop launched the Wall of Respect, which created a whole mural movement in the United States and the world, really, of Black people creating walls of commemoration of Black history, painting out on public walls. And next year is the 50th anniversary of the Wall of Respect, since it was done in 1967. And so we're working on all kinds of commemorative activities so that that innovation, the Wall of Respect, is remembered by the coming youth, so that they know that 50 years ago, people were doing something important. And I think every community has historical events that were very important, but they often get forgotten. And we have a responsibility to dig into local Black history so that every community begins to raise up the best examples of what it can be. Because if we've been something important, we can be something important again. And we have all been important. And so that I think, is the key point, is for people to dig into the history of your local community, raise up your heroes, raise up the moments when the greatest fightbacks occurred, raise up those organizations that were dedicated to freedom. I think that's the way in which to invest in the personality and the psychology and the consciousness of the youth so they can begin to imagine a future that they can fight for.
So what you're saying is that in Toronto, we build up what the local revolutionaries in Chicago and in Brazil, whichever city or whichever community it is, we start specifically with where we are and then go international, because I know we are not narrow nationals, we're international, so we deal with the history of local and international. I think that's
right.
What you're saying.
That's right.
So, for example, in Toronto, we would build up a Gene Daniels and a Jackie Schaffenberg at the same time that we would build up Queen and Zynga, Dessalines, Toussaint, and Christoph.
That's right. But the main thing is the link between the global, that is something that happened someplace else, and something that happened right here on this block, in this neighborhood.
Right, 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 okay.
In this city. Because if somebody's from someplace else, they come to this city, they have to also understand that this is where they live now. And
we have to struggle.
We're on the ground here right now. So your kids are going to that school system. You know, you're going to shop in that store. And you're going to get a job right here. But at the same time, no local struggle can be looked at independent, as you point out, you know, with the rest of the nation and the world.
All right, Abdul, I'm sorry, but we have to end this because we are getting ready to talk to L. Jones in Halifax, Nova Scotia. And I would like to, on behalf of Melinda and Lisa, thank you very much for your contribution.
Always a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
And continue listening to Diasporic Music. We're getting ready to pay tribute to Maurice White, who joined the ancestors couple of days ago.
You're listening to WhoRadio.com, voice of the International African Revolution.
You believe in freedom, cannot rest until it comes. You believe in freedom, cannot rest. Hear me talking to you. We who believe in freedom, cannot rest until it comes. Until the killing of black men. Mother's sons is as important as the killing of white men. White mother's sons, we who believe in freedom cannot rest.
Sing it with me if you like it.
We who believe in freedom cannot rest until it comes. The older I get, the better I know that the secret of my going on is when the reins are in the hands of the young who dare to run against the storm. Cause to me, young
people converse. They have the courage where we fail. And if I can but shed some light, I'll they carry us through the gales. We who believe in freedom and our rest. Hear me talking to ya. We who believe in freedom and our rest.
Oh, you're listening to Diasporic Music on Uhuru Radio. My name is Norman Richmond, and I'm joined by Melinda Francis, a.k.a. Molly, and Lisa Watson is on the buttons, and I'll turn it over to Molly.
Hey, Al, it's Melinda here. So I was just wondering, we haven't had you on the show for a while, so I just wanted to get your take or your sum up for 2015 on the East Coast.
The sum up to 2015 on the East Coast?
Yeah.
Well, music-wise or just in general?
Music-wise, in general.
In general, I think, first of all, we're seeing a big youth movement back on the East Coast. I know in the studio, for example, the music studio that we help create for the youth, we've had a ton of youth creating music, and politically conscious Black music is on a rise. I think we have youth that are influenced by Kendrick, they're influenced by Black Lives Matter, they're influenced by, you know, the repoliticizing of Black disproportionate through, like, yes, particularly through understanding that police brutality is active upon their own bodies. And in response to that, I think there's just been a real pushback in terms of youth creating, like, political resistant art. It's, you know, good to see, really good to see. So I would say for the year, that's the thing that stood out most to me was that the young people are really back with a vengeance in terms of claiming their blackness, in being willing to write about Black topics, in trying to gain that education and doing it through the arts. So that's really the most encouraging thing on the East Coast right now. At the same time, we're in a growing crisis, as most, I think, Black communities are. So there's been, like, more discussion about environmental racism, gentrification in our communities, which is intensifying, the closing of schools. There was recently, it wasn't 2015, I guess, but, like, a couple of weeks ago, there was a presentation to the school board that, you know, raised the fact that this huge potential Black kids are on individualized program plans, like, pulled out of the mainstream classroom. So we're still confronting those issues. Mass incarceration, which unfortunately we don't have too much of a movement against here, but trying to build that. So on the positive side, I think our young people are on the move. And even with, like, fashion blogging and, you know, street fashion and, yeah, like, just starting to see, like, natural hair in Halifax and Nova Scotia, which is really new. We're a bit behind usually on that kind of thing. And seeing, like, twists and braids and, you know, this kind of stuff that you actually didn't see, like, 10 years ago. So I think there's a rise in people's pride in Blackness overall, and that's the encouraging part. And, of course, I guess George Eliot Clark being elected Parliamentary Poet Laureate, I suppose that's a thing that Nova Scotia is.
What does that mean in terms of parliamentary? That's over the whole the Canadian government?
Yeah, I mean, it depends how much you believe in the state and parliament, I suppose. Like, with that, you know, whether or not we believe that representation within the organs of the state is any kind of route for liberation, which is a conversation we ought to be having in Black History Month, or as Ajamu Nangwaya would say, you know, African Liberation Month. But, yeah, I mean, George Eliot Clark was selected as the poet for parliament in Ottawa.
And what are some of the political events that took place in 2015 in Halifax and on the east coast of Canada?
Well, I mean, political organizing is difficult here, partly because for a long time the government has sort of taken political energy and put it into government-run, or people get so mad at me in Nova Scotia for saying this on the radio, but we have a lot of government-run organizations that, you know, supposedly take care of education or culture, and kind of the function of that and the reason why the state, I think, is supported is because it's intended to sort of funnel Black resistance into these official channels. So you had, you know, BUF, like Black United Front, you know, Rocky Jones. We had the Panther movement that came up to Nova Scotia. So we had a real, obviously, Black Power grassroots movement in Nova Scotia that began with the destruction of Africville, the black community that was bulldozed. It didn't begin there, but I mean, it was really coalesced around that where people really saw the state's intention towards black people and organized. And through the 70s and even the 80s, you had, you know, a lot of black activism. And then you have the creation of state-run organizations that I think to a certain extent takes that energy. So, you know, when you have a complaint about the education of your child, you're supposed to go to the organization instead of, you know, get in the streets or sit in or challenge a principal. And I think that's had an effect on the way that black organization and political organization happens in the province. And I think we're still kind of fighting our way out from under that, which is why I emphasize youth, because I think that, you know, their energy is going to be, is important in their kind of growing to consciousness and their movements outside those structures, which I think have been a bit of stifling upon political activity in Nova Scotia. So, like, I do a lot of work around prisons, and I can't say that there's a lot of movement in the black community to take that on, you know, to actually think about incarceration. Some of it's due to social conservatism, but I think some of it is due to, like, we don't have structures anymore for mass organizing. And I think that's something that we need to work on the East Coast. It's, we're seeing it, you know, in other places. So we saw a lot of the universities like York and, I don't know, across Canada, you saw black students, you know, going out against the universities, and that didn't really happen here yet, you know. So we did have a huge rally in 2014 against police violence, but, you know, not really last year. So I think getting the structures together for us to be protesting what we need to protest is a long road. At the same time, we have stuff like, I think we have very advanced activity on, like, environmental racism, where there was a project, Greenwich Project, that really identified that this was a problem in our community. So over 30% of black and indigenous communities in Nova Scotia are within, like, 5 kilometers, and even 1 kilometer of a landfill or, you know, some kind of environmental disaster. So, you know, Hammond's Plains, they were taking the water from the lake, giving it to the city and charging Hammond's Plains on the water, their own water, while they were drinking from well water. You know, so this has been a long practice in Nova Scotia. And I think there's a lot more awareness of the reality of what environmental racism is and people organizing against it. I think we've seen some movement between Indigenous and African people, which is always a challenge in the province. But I think there's growing recognition that we need to be on the same page in terms of a lot of this activity. So, you know, there's bright spots. I think it's always difficult to organize in this province. So partly because our communities are kind of far apart. So there's about 20,000, there's 27, I believe, communities. So it's, you know, how do you organize rural communities that are separate, and people have separate community identities? And that's always been the challenge in Nova Scotia. And it's one that we need to overcome, but it's, you know, slow and difficult.
Jones, let me ask you this. This is the 50th anniversary of the founding of the Black Panther Party for Self-Defense, which we know as the Black Panther Party. But the Black Panther Party started, I just want to get some history straight. The Black Panther Party really started in Lowndes County, Alabama. And but the Black Panther Party that we basically know today is the Panther Party that was started by Huey P. Newton and Bobby Seale in Oakland, California. And that particular branch of the Panthers, Rocky Jones, was a part of through Kwame Ture. Could you give us some history of that?
Yeah, so Rocky Jones was very involved in the international black movement as well. So the battle against apartheid. He first became involved in politics and, you know, fighting for voting rights in the South. So he had a long history of international blackness, which you don't always acknowledge. I think it's important. You know, we tend to think of him as sort of an intensely local figure, because also part of his mission was obviously, like, informing us of local black history and making sure we knew about African Nova Scotians and those lineages. But he was also very globally involved. And so he met Miriam McCabe, I believe, is what happened. At there's a huge conference in Montreal as well that he was part of, that's detailed in, oh my gosh, I'm blanking on his name. The book about, oh my goodness, I'm totally blanking. So there's a good book about the Black Power movement, like, in Montreal, and there was a huge conference. And I believe
that was David Alston's
David
book,
Austin,
right?
Yes. So I believe Rocky had met Miriam Makeba, He sort of said the fishing was really good in Nova Scotia, and there was fishing and hunting, and why don't you come out and relax, basically. And that was when she was married to Stokely, like Kwame Ture. So they ended up coming to Nova Scotia, and there was a big, like, fuss. Like, oh, my gosh, like, they're bringing the Panthers, and they're bringing these armed militants up to Nova Scotia, but really they were just coming here to kind of hang out. But Rocky knew what he was doing with the media. There was this sort of story that, you know, they were gathering guns and, you know, getting together to create arms traction against the state. But so he had brought Stokely in, Stokely at the time. And then there was this movement, that Black Power movement within Nova Scotia. People sometimes think there was a Panther chapter in Nova Scotia. I've learned that it's not true. So some people have said that for a long time we believed that there was an actual Panther chapter, but I guess that's not the case. But there was certainly activity influenced by the Panthers within Nova Scotia. Nova Scotia also has a long Garveyite history as well, particularly because in the Cape Breton, there was a lot of people from Barbados, a lot of Caribbean people that came to work in the mines. So
I don't want to cut you, but are there still Liberty Halls in 2016, are there still Garvey Hall?
Yeah, I opened one 2 years ago. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So we're one of the only places in Canada to embrace Garveyism, to be using African and, you know, the same, when everyone was still using Negro and color, we were using African, you know, African United Baptist Association. Well, that's even prior Garvey. So there was a large Garveyite presence. The story is that Bob Marley's song, Redemption Song, is based on the speech that Marcus Garvey actually gave in Halifax. So, mm-hmm. Yeah, so there is a lineage of Black Power going back also to, you know, like the loyalist slaves, like enslaved Africans that were escaping and identifying as Africans. So that lineage played into where Rocky Jones was. But we had a Black Power movement, and there was an embrace particularly of Blackness. So when we were working on a grassroots level, everything was called Black. And then when the government kind of shifted, everything became, you know, you don't see the word Black anymore. Like, none of our organizations are, like, identified as Black, which is, like, interesting. But
you're listening to Diasporic Music, and Amanda, ask next question.
Well, I think I just wanted to go back to the point of sort of, the struggle to build infrastructure for us to organize, because I think it's sort of widespread that's issue. I mean, it plays out differently in different localities, but so I just wanted to know your ideas of what that looks like in the upcoming year and how we can sort of support each other locally, from local to local community, and what do you think that would look like as well?
I think I still am a mouth tongue theory fortnight, as the Panthers were. I think, you know, you have to build the capacity and community to organize for themselves. And I think that begins with sort of small incremental organizing, you know, so we tend to sort of attack the issue, like, okay, there's prisons and how do we get rid of prisons. But I think it's important to begin with, say, identifying a need, like maybe it's around phone calls that are expensive, and then organizing people to protest that. And when you can, you know, successfully challenge that, you're building, as you challenge that, you're building the groups you need to organize on greater issues, you know, like building trust in the community, helping people understand how they use their power. So I think it's that, you know, so organizing on schools right now, something as small as like creating mentorship programs with university students to young students. You're building the responsibility of the university students. You're bringing them into the community. You're connecting the community back. So those things, I think it starts with those small steps. You know, can you do something achievable? Can you demonstrate to the community you're working with that, you know, like anybody who's not from the community has community's best interests and is willing to listen? You know, how do you get people within the community to feel empowered to work within their own community? So we have like a community center that does a lot of this stuff, so it deals with like even stuff like literacy programming, like crafting. It's all needs based, so it's based on what particularly the woman in the community want. And I think that is organizing, right? You're building capacities of people to feel recognized, to come together. And then from there, when there's political issues, like we have a huge issue around housing right now, like a lot of the public housing is being privatized, and then so the rent has gone up for some women from, you know, sort of like $2.95 to $1,200, like overnight. And similar to what's, I think, going on in Toronto, where they put in these ridiculous sort of no noise after 9 p.m., no one with a criminal record, you know, so just laws that people can't really meet and that are clearly disproportionately placed upon black households. So, you know, then you run, you play music after 9 and you're getting removed from housing, you don't have any form of appeal, right, which is all part of gentrification. So to organize people around that when people are scared of being evicted, when people don't know where they're going to go, it's difficult. But how do you get those women to feel empowered enough to fight? And those are the questions that I think it's just on a daily basis, like being within communities, using the people in the communities that have the voice in communities, and making sure they have the tools and support to organize in their own communities. And it's just step by step by step, right? Like it can't be, you know, huge issues. I think you just start small, and everything that you do successfully builds hope. I think, you know, despair is the enemy of the revolution, right? So we always have to proceed with hope and make sure we're doing manageable things that we feel that, you know, we feel dedicated to and that we can succeed in. So that's really, yeah, I mean, I was in America for a while too, so I sort of had to step back from organizing community, and it's like getting back up to speed a bit, you know?
Yeah.
Let me ask you this question. In terms of 2016, how does Nova Scotia, how does Halifax look in terms of the racial composition of people coming in from various communities from around the world, coming into all over the world? What is Halifax like
so
in terms of the people that are there now?
We're getting, I believe, 10,000 refugees, many who are living now in like the northern neighborhoods, the traditional black neighborhoods. And I think that discussion, no, I don't mean on the xenophobic form, like, why are we taking refugees and giving resources? You know, I don't mean that, but I think there are legitimate questions about the way that we treat, say, African people within Canada and the narratives around why African people are not deserving of resources, you know? So there's been a lot of that kind of question. I don't mean in the way of, like, we shouldn't give resources to refugees, because clearly that's an austerity argument and there's more than enough resources. But I mean the kind of narrative where people are willing to believe that, you know, the refugees are deserving of help and resources, but African people in their own communities deserve it somehow. So, you know, they should be deprived. So I think it's going to be interesting in terms of how it plays into things like gentrification. You know, the movement of black people out of traditional housing, is the government going to, you know, use refugees as a wedge issue and use them to move into housing and then push out black people? And what kind of solidarity can we have between, you know, a refugee population coming in and, you know, an indigenous and black population that's here, which is a necessary solidarity. So I think that is going to be an increasing, it's potential for helping us move forward, you know, so, for example, in Joseph Howe School in the North, and they'd be systematically sort of threatening to close that school and systematically removing the school population so that it's very small. There's only 80 children left in school because most parents are like, I don't know if the school's going to be open next year, so I'll send my kid to a different school. And there's been an injection of refugee children into that school. So with those numbers, the parents, if we can all work together as African parents, you know, African community members and refugees, we have more strength there. So I think it's those kind of alliances that need to be made, but I think it's also quite clear that the state has no intention of those alliances being made, and that part of the rhetoric around refugees is to, I think, position refugees somewhat against black and indigenous communities, like implicitly so.
Let me ask you before I turn it over to Melinda again, but I want one other question is, how many Latinos have come to Nova Scotia? There's a lot of people, Spanish-speaking people, are coming to Ontario. Are they? Coming to?
Nova Scotia's changing. So even like 10 years ago, Nova Scotia was pretty much like white, and then 4% black, and then, you know, an indigenous population. You know, so like Nova Scotia was over like 93% white or something, and you're seeing a change. Slowly. So, you know, far more African. We used to just consider, like, even with Chinese or Indian or something, pretty much just be like, oh, they're black, because there wasn't really multiculturalism. So you're like black or you weren't black. And now there's definitely
right.
Like, you know, so if someone be Indian, be like, oh, you're basically black, you know, because there wasn't a South Asian community. And there is a change with immigration. There's far more Africans coming in particular. But still, no, I mean, it's not like Toronto where you have massive multiculturalism. It's very slowly changing, definitely. Yeah, like now it's not unusual to not see white people downtown or something. But
so you don't see Europeans selling burritos and tacos and enchiladas, and they don't even taste that well. But
well, we have like burrito jacks. We don't have, you know. There's always a small population, but not in like this significant amount. That may be changing, but. There's a growing Muslim population, certainly, and the people from the Middle East. A lot of Africans, I would say, would be the biggest change I've noticed.
You have a mosque there?
Yes, there's a Muslim mosque there? Yeah.
Okay, all right.
Plus, I mean, I think that there's a growth in, we're seeing growth in the Muslim population in particular, which is sort of interesting because they've been sort of forced to do things like wear a hijab day to, you know, try and get rid of the intense Islamophobia that they suffer from. But, it's still not that multicultural. Like Halifax is not that multicultural a city, and certainly not compared to like Toronto, Montreal. And traditionally, the line has sort of been, like Indigenous Black people and white people. And that's sort of, and then obviously Mi'kmaq. And there hasn't been much in between. So the extent to which immigration refugees changes that, I think, is always a question, because do people take solidarity with African people, or, you know, anti-Black racism, which is present in a lot of other cultures? Does that result in triangulation where you have, you know, the new people come in and they don't take common cause of the Africans that are here? And I think we often see that pattern even among other African people, right, who have a sort of class-based disdain for working-class Africans in the community. And so that can be difficult, you know, like when the sort of narratives that you get about why are these people here so lazy, you know, why can't they pull themselves up? And so doing that solidarity work is important as well between African Nova Scotians, Africans, Caribbeans, which is something that has historically been a source of tension. So.
Are you listening to Diasporic Music on Uhuru Radio? And let Melinda turn it over to Melinda.
I wanted to know, like, what was, I guess, going back to your work and what's coming up for you? What have you been working on? Artistically.
What have I been working on artistically? I've been doing a lot of journalism, actually. So I work for, not full time or anything, I have a column in an independent online newspaper. So I'm able to do a lot of Black based news. I do a lot of like prison news. But spoken word is like always the same. I mean, I think for me, prison work has been, it's always been something I do, but I think it's very intensified. A lot of my work is around that as well, in terms of collaborating with people inside to tell stories. We're working on a play telling the stories of people inside, and we're having people that are formerly incarcerated will be performing. So that for me is, I guess, what I see as the most important direction for my work, which is like collaborating with voices inside to get those voices out into the community. So that's really where things have been directed for me. But I can do a poem if you want. I don't know.
Yeah, that'd be amazing.
Okay. So on that topic, hang on, I have to wait for my song to load. So
you can could you do one on where I know your language is almost as spicy as mine. Whatever you want to do, as long as you don't use a spicy language.
No, this one is actually
just joking.
Judges, so there's no language in it. So here we go. I know a man who stabbed a man inside and got sent off to the shoe. But he says when somebody comes after you, then what else did you do? I don't believe that he's a monster, but that's what the system say, and now he's doing double life and might not see the light of day. And when you're 15 and your family teaches you to sell crack, well, is there any coming back? So you go to manhood in the max, and we define entire lives by a person's worst act. So we just list their various crimes and believe we have the facts. So here's another story of another lost defendant. He's 20 years old, and he's 8 years into his sentence, brought over to the prison from juvenile detention. Sometimes children in this country, they just don't deserve a mention until they commit a crime, and then suddenly we pay attention. There are people in society we label as disposable when you're already doing time. Shouldn't be the first time you're diagnosable, and so we put them in a prison where at least they are controllable, and I suppose it isn't notable, and no one gets emotional unless we find out that they're innocent.
Okay, it looks like we lost the connection with Elle Jones, so I will try to get her back.
Oh, did she just drop?
Yep, she just dropped, so I'll try to get her back.
Her phone sounds kind of shaky in terms. She must be probably on the cell, right?
Yeah.
We have no control over that.
Yeah.
Yeah, we got 4 minutes left, so yeah.
Your call has been forwarded to a voicemail service that has not been initialized by the customer you are calling.
Hello, hello. She might still be running her poem and not even know she's off. Right?
Yeah, no, that's what I'm thinking.
We'll
believe in freedom, cannot rest. You believe in freedom, cannot rest until it comes. We'll believe in freedom. Hear me talking to you. We believe in freedom and not rest until it comes. Until the killing of black men, black mothers, sons, is as important as the killing of white men, white mothers, sons.
You're listening to Diasporic Music, and we lost Elle Jones, but we have her back.
I'm back. Now I forgot my alarm. I don't know. I feel like that poem is lost, so I'm going to do a different poem. Like, that poem wasn't meant to be on the air. The phone didn't want to beat it.
Exactly.
So, I'll do this poem. Canada is so polite. It's like someone bumps into us in the Tim Hortons line, and we say sorry. We're always saying sorry. Well, I mean, not to the Indigenous people for stealing their land. And Harper only could have apologized for residential schools while crossing the fingers on his hand. And not to Angelique, who we hanged. And not to everyone we bombed in Afghanistan. And not for the internment of the Japanese or for the deaths on the railroad built by the Chinese. And not for breaking the treaties or racist immigration policies. But we're so polite. We always say please. Well, not to our migrant workers or imported nannies, but they should get down on their knees because Canada is the promised land. Now, there was no slavery, just the Underground Railroad, because Canada is a gravy train. So forget about the ass runaway slaves in the Halifax newspapers. Canada is a safe haven for lazy immigrants who come here, and we just give you welfare earned by hard-working white taxpayers because Canada is so white. Just rosy-cheeked white people playing in the snow on the ice. Just snowshoeing and canoeing all day and night. And okay, those things were stolen from Indigenous people too, but we invented hockey, right? Oh wait, it was black people who invented the slap shot and butterfly goaltending. Well, we hide that all out of sight. And that's why Canada is so quiet. Everyone in Canada is so nice. And let's not mention the Shelburne race riots or cross burnings or Africville or 1,200 missing and murdered Indigenous women, but there's no genocide. It's rude to raise your voice in Canada. So let's just smile. Canadians aren't racist. We're peacekeepers. We're civilized. And Don Cherry's a national icon, but Canadians aren't violent or bigots. That's just hockey fights. Canadians are perky. Now, there's no dirty secrets here. Canada is just quirky. Like, we say Z and not Z. But if you talk about racism, we'll be like, there's no need for that here. Canada is never abusive. Canada is so inclusive. Canada is so inclusive, and the proof is that we let other people be here. It's like, I stole your land, and now I'm throwing a party, but you can stand at the back if you show us ID. It's like, I just put you in the hospital.
listen here. Let me start you an idea. It's like, what are you complaining for? You got 6 weeks of the Book of Negroes on TV. It's like we're going to hoard all the toys, but we might just give you what if you ask us nicely. We could acknowledge you have things to offer us, but that's not likely. It's like P.K. Subban. We might let you be on the Olympic hockey team if you just stop being so black. I mean, so hockey. It's not about race. It's about character. We just don't want you to embarrass your country. It's just your attitude. I'm not saying anything ugly. I mean, you should realize you're so lucky. It's not like America here. There's no history of segregation. That's why we wear Canadian flags in our backpacks and we travel abroad, because Canada has such a good reputation. I mean, we get to travel. You probably don't, but you just don't know how to teach English to those Asians or build houses in Africa. The country, of course, not the continent. Canadians are helpful because Canada is so tolerant, which means we know your culture is worse than ours, but we let you do your primitive things because Canada is so confident that we know better than you, because our way of doing things is just dominant. We even let you wear your hijab. Unless it's Quebec. It's just unfortunate that your culture makes you so oppressed. It's not about racism. It's just about respect for our shared values. We like your little costumes. They're so colorful. Because Canada is multicultural. We just wish that all you people of color could be more punctual. It's just that white culture is just more functional. But we just love diversity. And forget about how the majority of the country votes conservative. It's just amazing that so many different cultures go to our child's nursery. But then we complain when you get an affirmative action bursary. Canada's multicultural as long as you put white people first. We like your food, fun, and fashion, but past that, isn't it kind of like racism in reverse? I mean, it's so unfair how black and native people get free university. We just want to make sure that everyone's worthy because Canada has so much courtesy. We speak English and French. Okay, not perfectly. All right, most people only know the French words for cereals, but let's not be absurd. This is still an English country. Or haven't you heard? There's no distinct societies in Canada. And that's why Canada is so bland. Nothing to see here, just miles upon miles of stolen indigenous land. Just fishermen and farmers and maple syrup, because that's Canada's brand. Just fields of wheat and outdoor ice rinks and all thy son's command. There's no guns and violence here, just socialist health care plans. And just ignore the environmental damage of the oil sands, because Canada is so grand, so good at perpetuating this international scam, so sincere at pretending there's no blood on our hands, because Canada's not like that. Canada's white as a lamb. And those other people, they're still angry. But true Canadians just don't understand.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. And I would like to say that at 4 p.m., I am going to do a show called The Desmond Cole Show. And if you want to listen, you can go to www.
Desmond Cole?
Yeah, newstalk1010.com. That's www.newstalk1010.com. And I would like to thank L. Jones for...
thank you for having me.
And you're one of our favorite guests, and we definitely like the link between Halifax, Toronto, and we're international, so we want to plug into in the world.
Of course, as always.
And you're definitely our link to the eastern part of Canada.
Well, peace to everybody, and happy African Liberation Month. Hopefully we're not just using this time to, randomly celebrate notable firsts, but, we're actually trying to use the reflection of our ancestors to continue to organize our communities today and work towards our liberation. So, happy Black Month.
I agree.
And, thank you for having me.
Thank you.
Bye. Bye.
And Melinda Francis, a.k.a. Molly, Lisa Watson on the buttons. I guess we're going to do our tribute to Maurice White, and in the last hour, we're going to be listening to Dr. Gerald Horn from 4 to 5 talk about Haiti, and I think Martella, Dr. Funkenstein, has been run out. Is that correct, Melinda?
Yes.
All right.
So stay tuned to Diasporic Music on Uhuru Radio. We will see you. Oh, we are on until 5. So take care of yourself and continue to listen. Uhuru, you are listening to Diasporic Music on Uhuru Radio. My name is Jalali, aka Norman Otis Richmond, and we are paying tribute to Maurice White. Maurice White joined the ancestors at the age of 74 recently. Maurice White was born in Memphis, Tennessee, and he grew up in Chicago. And his father was a doctor, and his grandfather was a pianist in New Orleans. And Maurice White played with some of the greatest musicians on the planet Earth. He was a session musician for a while with Chess Records, a record company out of Chicago. And he backed up people, blues people, Willie Dixon and so on and so forth. He was on a lot of those records. And he also played with Ramsey Lewis, a great musician out of Chicago. And he picked up an instrument called the kalimba, or the thumb piano, an African thumb piano. And we are going to pay tribute to Maurice White in this segment, on this segment of Diasporic Music on Uhuru Radio. So as Maurice White would say, let's groove. You are listening to Diasporic Music on Uhuru Radio. My name is Norman Otis Richmond, speaking to you from the Great White North here in Toronto, Canada. I'm your bluesologist, and we are paying tribute to Maurice White of Earth, Wind, and Fire. And we are getting ready to listen to a song called Reasons. This is a live version of Reasons. And Earth, Wind, and Fire signed first with Warner Brothers Records, and they had came from Chicago, and but they didn't come from Chicago. Maurice White, keep on getting them. Every time I think about Maurice White, I'm thinking about Maurice Bishop, but we're talking about Maurice White. Maurice White moved to California and put together a group. And he signed with Warner Brothers, and I think they did two records, two albums for Warner Brothers. And then they were signed by Clive Davis at Columbia Records. And one of the lead singers, other than Maurice White, was Philip Bailey, nice falsetto guy. And we're going to listen to Philip Bailey singing Reasons live. This is a record that they play to death. If you listen to Stevie Wonder station, you'll hear this song all of the time. Reasons, the live rendition is 8:33. And then we're going to listen to a cover version of Keep Your Head to the Sky by Mesa Leek. I hope I'm pronouncing the sister's name correctly. Last week we played a song that was supposed to be CeeLo. That's straightening out, but it wasn't CeeLo. It was someone else, so we're trying to keep everything right today. And let us listen to Earth, Wind, and Fire featuring the voice of Philip Bailey, who is out of Denver, Colorado.
Ladies and gentlemen, Mr. Don Myrick on the alto horn. He plays so beautiful, don't you agree?
He said, it's all about love. It's all about love, oh baby.
Check this out. You hear me? I go,
Sky.
Lafia, you're listening to Diasporic Music on Uhura Radio. My name is Norman Richmond, speaking to you from Toronto, Canada. We are paying tribute to Maurice White, the founder of Earth, Wind, and Fire. And those were he was born under, not an astrologist or into astrology, but those were his signs, and he was deeply entrenched in Egyptology. He actually went to Egypt, and he was into that type of ideology. And we are going to listen to Maurice White do Shining Star with Earth, Wind, and Fire, and then we're going to hear a brief interview with Maurice White and his younger brother, Verdeen White, the great bass player. And Maurice White was 10 years older than Verdeen White. And Verdeen White is 10 years younger than Maurice, and he gives his brother credit for everything. And he says his mother was very proud of the example that Maurice set for Verdeen. Verdeen, one of the greatest bass players and great showmen. And let's listen to an interview with Verdeen and Maurice. But first, let us listen to Shining Star.